these kind of questions. What role in Chapter 1 does defense play within the developmental state of Islam? 2, the strategic environment and the future conflict. The borderless nature of conflict is not even borders, non-state actors and all that kind of stuff. 3, expressing South Africa's security policy and foreign policy and how South Africa puts
went around the transformation of the defence function, security sector reform, and looking at what is this future role that this military should play in support of a democratic society. That is the way we are constituted, and it's what our constitution said we should be doing. We looked at the developmental challenges of South Africa being at that time, and we concluded exactly what in the same vein as the National Planning Commission did with regard to poverty, income equality, unemployment, education, and criminality being the fundamental challenges that were impacting human security in South Africa. Because we have to take cognizance of that, because it's part and parcel of the security landscape. And I think it is important to note that in the building of the Defence Review, we were very closely related to, and we paid particular attention not only to the work done by the National Planning Committee in the development of the National Development Plan, but also the State Security Agency in the development of a national security strategy. So we were cognizant of that. And the general approach to the work that we were doing in the Defence Review at that particular point of time was that we would deal with the detail of defence, and the National Development Plan would deal with the periphery to defence. I think it's in Chapter 6, might be in Chapter 6, one of the other ones. I'm also involved in agriculture, so sometimes I get the chapters confused. And then, of course, we create an understanding in this Defence Review of the potential contributions that this defence organisation can make towards national development and national development imperatives. Hugely important. In this strategic environment, we looked globally at what the challenges were from a security perspective affecting the world. Persistent regional local conflicts, violent political, ethnic and religious extremism, acts of terror, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, involvement of non-state actors in conflict, and high levels of international crime and cyber threats. I think pretty much most of that should resonate with you, because that we're starting to see, and we do see to a greater or lesser extent in South Africa. From a continental perspective, one of the big challenges that we face is the lack of political rights, weakened dysfunctional states, ethnicity and marginalization of groups, inappropriate military involvements in political affairs, non-state actors and unconstitutional changes to governments, competition over scarce resources, and then of course poverty, underdevelopment, poor human security and endemic disease, and to top that, of course, maritime insecurity, crime and piracy. If we looked at the broad security overview of Africa, we identified six main drivers of conflict, and I'm not going to go into the detail other than to say political uncertainty, maritime crime, border disputes, fundamentalism and extremism, rebel forces and resource-driven conflicts were the primary drivers of conflict on the African continent. And when we looked at this and we pulled it all together and we looked at other work done by other international organizations, we came to exactly the same conclusion. There were six primary zones of conflict on the African continent. And luckily for us, SADC, we are probably the most peaceful region on the African continent. But there's significant challenges in the rest of Africa that have major impact on us. If we look at migration, for example, we look at the continental divide and the tensions that exist along that divide between Islam and Christianity and how that impacts on the security environment and what that ultimately does to migration, push forces and pull forces. We've heard find ourselves in a situation where we are going to have to look outside the borders of our country for our vital interests. For example, our maritime zones, for example, water, the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, for example, is an absolutely critical importance, certainly to the province of Gauteng and the industrial hub of South Africa. And then, of course, electricity going forward and what's going to be happening with the Congo River and the Inga scheme, the Grand Inga scheme, and what role will South Africa have to play, how much will we benefit out of it, and then, of course, what is our role in protecting it. And then, of course, the enduring stability, unity, and prosperity of the region is in our interest in growing the South African economy going forward. What we did in the defence review was we looked at the vital interest that defence would have to concern itself with. This is done in consultation with DIRCO in terms of understanding exactly what is vital to South Africa. And obviously protecting our sovereignty and our territorial integrity remains vital. We as a nation state have that in our interests. So the Defence Force has to busy itself and understand what role it has to play in that regard. Securing vital resources, the second vital interest, such as the minerals and energy and water that we require to maintain our nation state. And then, of course, safeguarding our ability to trade. I think one of the aspects we tend not to give enough credence to is how much we rely on maritime routes of trade as a country in terms of our economy and how much of our economy is actually reliant on our ability to export goods and also to import goods. But not only that, the fact that we're strategically positioned in the world, the Southern Cape and the Cape Sea routes, and most of the super tankers that can't go through the Suez Canal have to come around the Cape route. So a lot of the world trade happens in our close proximity. And of course, peace, stability, and economic development being the fourth vital interest. It's in our interest to make sure that that happens, and we as a defence force have to be focused on what it is that we need to do to ensure that happens. The strategic concept of defence that is defined in the defence review is the following. We have a layered approach to it, three layers. The first layer, to influence the international security agenda through optimised defence diplomacy and active multilateral and bilateral engagements and the involvement in the United Nations, the African Union, SAEC security structures. That is layer one. Layer two is to safeguard the South African state and its people and its territory. And the second part of that is to promote peace, security, and development on the continent through participation in peace support and allied operations. Layer three, if the first two fail, layer three is to collaboratively or deliberately, another word for deliberately is unilaterally, protect our vital interests and defend the sovereignty of the Republic of South Africa against any imminent or direct threat. So in short, that is the approach to defence strategically, and of course the Defence Force has a particular strategy that it would then follow accordingly. So the defence mission is to defend and protect South Africa's territory, its sovereignty and its people, and enhance peace, security, and development. That translates broadly into four goals and 13 tasks. Goal one being defending and protecting South Africa. I won't go into the detail on this slide because I'm going to talk to a little bit of detail now. Goal two is the safeguarding of South Africa, slightly different. And then goal three is promoting peace and security. Goal four is developmental and other ordered tasks, and I'll go into the detail of that very briefly. If we look at directing defence, a lot of emphasis is given in this chapter to the fundamental roles of the President, the Minister of Defence, and in our case the Minister of Defence and Military Veterans, as she is known, and of course the role of the Executive in directing defence matters. The concepts of civil control and civil oversight are very clearly defined in the Defence Review, as being two distinct concepts. And then, of course, the intertwined with that is the requirement for an unfettered line of military command from the commander-in-chief down to a unit commander at ground level who might be executing operations. One doesn't want any effect civil control by the Minister of Defence, and to a large extent the Defence Secretariat was brought into being to give effect to that, to strengthen the Minister's ability to provide civil control over the defence function in its entirety. And then of course mechanisms to enhance civil oversight by Parliament, and that's your role as a committee. The role of the Secretary of Defence, particularly with regard to particular designation as the Head of Department and Accounting Officer, the role of the Chief of the Defence Force as the Commander of the Defence Force, and then of course understanding the command and staff requirement within defence, the recognised command and staff system that is internationally accepted and has been proven over about 400 years to be really efficient, and then of course the regulatory framework for the utilisation of the Defence Force. In Chapter 5, Goal 1, and this is where I get into a little bit of detail, the Defence Force has the following constitutionally prescribed tasks: deterring and preventing conflict, protecting national interests, and defending South Africa. And of course, this requires a specific balance of military capabilities to be able to do that. Goal 2 is safeguarding South Africa. And this extends largely to, for example, border safeguarding. And border safeguarding is not just about the land borders. And I think we need to be mindful of the fact that we're talking about sea borders or maritime zones, as well as our airspace. And very importantly, border safeguarding is the full ambit of those three functions. And in fact, probably is extended to the cyberspace and the digital domain as we move into the fourth industrial revolution. Safeguarding critical infrastructure as a contingent liability, where defence has to be able to protect critical infrastructure should there be a threat, an emerging threat thereto. And then of course, supporting the police services, and I'm sure you're familiar as a committee with the work that gets done in this regard, and has been done over many years in South Africa internally, and we are busy with an operation now in the Western Cape together with the police and supporting the police, actually operating in collaboration with the police on a particular matter. And of course, ensuring information security, which is a higher order word of cyber defence. Goal 3, looking at promoting regional continental peace and security. I think one of the most important things is our ability to enhance our strategic influence, shaping the multilateral security agenda, pursuing critical multilateral critical multilateral security objectives, regional and continental partnerships, and then of course participating in selected bilateral mechanisms. We have a number of relationships with a number of countries, covered by announcements on that. Not necessarily that we have to have all that equipment for ourselves, but we certainly have to have partnerships with other countries where we can access that type of equipment. When you get into Chapter 9, we look at the planning of the development trajectory for the defence review. And I think at a starting point, I must point out that the defence review speaks to Milestone 4 as being the end state that the defence review speaks to, not the law force for South Africa. That is dictated by a different set of circumstances. But the Milestone 4 was the defence review committee, together with cabinet, to be the most appropriate level of defence that we should aspire to as a country, being that type of force that could quite competently deal with a range of conflict scenarios that might present themselves and that would are probable to happen as opposed to impossible to happen. So against that construct, Milestone 4 and the makeup of Milestone 4 was discussed. There were a number of critical success factors that were posited, and a number of them have been achieved. Unfortunately, there are two that are marked in red, appropriately funded and strategic partners in the quest to achieve Milestone 4. We have still got to get to that point. If we look at the change level of ambition that is posited by the Defence Force, because I think this is very important, in the 1998 Defence Review, it largely looked at security sector reform, the new role of defence, it looked at integration, transformation of the armed forces, and it didn't really contemplate the real role that this defence force should play as an asset in South Africa. This defence review, of course, has a completely different outlook. So if we looked at the 1998 defence review, it posited the concept of what we call a core growth capability, which really was tiny defence, relatively small defence force, the basic tools of the trade, if you like, in order to be able to defend this country should the need arise. However, it did not envisage that the Defence Force would be very busy on matters of national security. And in fact, in 1999, after the approval of the 98 Defence Review, the strategic circumstances fundamentally changed for the Defence Force. Despite the budget cut that it got in 1998, the Defence Force was tasked to get involved in peace missions external to the borders of this country, and it ultimately became one of the 10th largest troop contributing countries to the United Nations and peace support operations on the continent of Africa over the next few years, of course putting a lot of pressure on the budget. If we look at the Defence Review itself, it speaks to a number of milestones. Milestone 1, arresting the decline. Milestone 2, rebalancing of the Defence Force. Milestone 3, capacitating of the Defence Force. And then, of course, Milestone 4 being having a Defence Force with a suite of capabilities that could respond to pretty much any challenge that it faced. It wasn't the war force, though. And if we look at how this played itself out and where we were at the starting point, or where we are, in fact, still are as an organisation, is we have some of our capabilities that one could describe as being in core growth, but we have other capabilities that are nowhere close to that. And as a result of the decline that we've suffered, we had to prioritise budgets into those capabilities that we use on a daily basis, and to a large extent almost shelve those other capabilities that we do know that we require, but are unable to sustain. So when the committee then engaged with cabinet, it said to cabinet, look, we're going to give you three options. We're going to give you three strategic policy options that you can decide upon for the future of the Defence Force. We can reduce the size of the Defence Force to the current allocation, which at that time was approximately 43 billion or a billion rand, and it was about 1.2% of GDP at that time, the 2013 GDP. Or we can make a deliberate decision that we're going to certainly not a combat capable air force, but more of an air wing type air force where you integrate the air force into the army. And then of course it does not support in any way the continental leadership role that was expected in South Africa. Wouldn't really have gravitas to back up our diplomatic role as a country. And then of course it would not be able to fully comply with the constitutional requirement. It would largely be able to do constabulary or police type tasks, slightly stronger than the police force, but be able to do that. So that would be the kind of defence force that we could have developed out of a $43 billion budget should we have decided that was the type of defence force we wanted. But the expanded independently would be that type of defence force that you'd retain your sovereign independence. You'd have a capability commensurate with your continental expectations and role, and then of course significant ability to reach and intervene, and then of course the continental gravitas of vital interests which could be secured. Expanding in partnership would require on one or multiple strategic partners. It would, sure, improve your funding options, but you would have to give way to a degree of sovereignty in the development of your defence capability. And yes, you might achieve the end state of the defence review far quicker than if you tried to do it yourself. The interesting thing was Cabinet selected expanding independently. They selected it strategically, and at the time there was a very strong debate in Cabinet on whether or not we should accept this defence review with funding or without. And it was very clear, the decision was very clear, that in fact what was put on the table was that the economic growth projection for South Africa was expected to speed up to 3.5 to 4% over the following MTSF period. Of course, they didn't realise. So Cabinet made the decision in good faith, understanding that the economy was more than likely, and the projections were that we should have been growing at that point in time. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. I'm not going to go into the detail here because I know we need time for questions.
So yes, may I just ask for your indulgence? I know the ENSO colleagues have a business to the charge of a particular business in the ENSO, and which is setting out to capitalism. And I'm sure colleagues in the NA can can go beyond 2 by 10 minutes, 20 minutes is fine.
Done with this particular graphic is just to give you an indication graphically of what this defence force would have been, would be able to do or should be able to do. And I must caution the members that we are finding it increasingly difficult to just even do this on a day-to-day basis due to the fact that this is where we were in 2014, it was actually in 2013-14, this is where we were, and nothing has changed. In fact, we've gone backwards from this for the simple reason we actually had cuts to our allocation as opposed to the intended improvement in the allocation, incremental improvement in the allocation. I say incremental because I don't think anybody was under any impression that the Defence Force was suddenly moved from a defence allocation of 43 billion to 75 billion in one year. That would never have worked. But an incremental improvement as opposed to the
option tool would have required.
Over time, yes. Up to milestone 3 and then about, I think it was 84 billion for milestone 4. But I'm going to give you those numbers now when I go into it. So I just want to unpack what we could do. When we first looked at this, we said, right, if we're going to embark upon this path, which is the independently expanded defence force over time, and the timeline was 20 to 30 years, specified as such. It wasn't like we needed to achieve it in 5 years. It was over 20 to 30 years. We would grow the defence capability commensurate with South Africa's national security requirements and its foreign policy requirements, both aspects of it. So we looked at what we could do as a defence force, and we saw at that time we were participating in two-piece missions. We had an ability to intervene by way of some special forces. We were doing border safeguarding at a very low level. I think some of the members will recall we were at 12 army subunits deployed on the borders. We're now at 15. Not that we were funded for 15, but that is where we are now. And then, of course, we had one naval vessel that sometimes could patrol the maritime zone. So the colour scheme here is green, is yes, we could do it, we could sustain it, even though it's at a low level, we could do it. The red is unsustainable, it is stretching us to the limit, and of course the yellow is partially sustainable. So in the business of protecting and safeguarding South Africa and its maritime zone, its borders, its maritime zone, its airspace, we were partially sustainable. In the business of conducting the two medium-sized peace missions, we were not sustainable at all. We find ourselves, and we have to be perfectly honest about this, we found ourselves where we had to look from 15 military units. In fact, I think the worst case was about 40 military units, where we pulled individual people from 40 military units into a coherent force that we then deployed for a peace mission, as opposed to having that dedicated military unit, combat ready to go and operate in a particular peace mission. So that was where we were and how we found ourselves. So that's why we said it's unsustainable, not only from a people point of view, but also from an equipment point of view and our ability to maintain serviceability and be able to operate properly. And then, of course, the ability, the supply support system to logistically supply those missions was done with a great deal of stress with a declining air transport fleet in the form of the C-130s. That is where we were. So it was against that backdrop that we said, well, okay, so what are the plans? How are we going to, what are the next steps that should be taken? So the Defence Review looked very clearly at what he thought the situation was for Milestone 1 and what needed to be fixed in Milestone 1. What was the type of force that could be provided in Milestone 1? And at the end of the day, knowing that that's our point of departure and what we have to do to move forward. If we look then at the graphic, so if we take the milestones of the Defence Review, the task compliance on the left axis, or the y axis of the graph, indicates to what level can we comply with the recommendations of the Defence Review and for what missions. So the different goals. Goal 1, Goal 2, Goal 3, and Goal 4 are the different colour schemes in the histogram, the tall part. government expenditure, which translated at that time against that GDP at 1.1% of GDP. So that's really where we were. So if we said, right, okay,
so which year was it?
That was in 2013-14 initially. And it's what we put on this graph is the 2014-15 rand value.
This is in 2014-15 prices.
Prices, yeah. And if you'll recall, 2014-15, our GDP in billion US dollars was significantly over 300 billion US dollars. With the last couple of years, we've been under the 300 billion US dollars, which is very problematic because of the relative buying power and the complications that brings to defense. If we then, on this graph, let's say, okay, our aim is still to get to milestone 4. Our starting point is here where we are at milestone 1. We now need to move towards the milestone 2 position. What are the interventions that we have to make at that point of departure to get us to milestone 2? And all of these are graphically represented on this presentation, what you will find in chapter 9 of the defense review. It speaks to the trajectory of defense. So, in order to get to milestone 2, what do we want to improve? Obviously, the first thing we wanted to improve was we wanted to be able to say and tick the box, we can sustainably deploy 15 army subunits to protect our land borders. We can partially sustain 4 maritime patrol vessels. It could be a vessel, it could be a maritime vessel, it could be an aircraft that could patrol the maritime zone. And this would be hugely important. So the first point of departure is let's protect the homeland and let's make sure that our maritime zone and our borders and our airspace and our maritime resources are properly secured. That was the first point. That's what we have to do for our safety. We must make steady incremental improvement in terms of the peace missions that we are conducting. Still at this point, we envisage that we'll be conducting 2 large-scale peace missions, and we must maintain our ability to reach and intervene, even though it might be at a higher level. In milestone 1, our ability to reach and intervene was essentially the chief of the South African National Defence Forces Reserve, which is a company or a subunit of paratroopers. Was the capability that we could use, and perhaps a team of special forces that could accompany them. So in milestone 2, that is what we would seek to achieve. When we did the broadcasting of it, it would require that we move the defence budget from 43 to 57 billion. And it would definitely have set us on the path to arrest the decline completely. And we'd be in a position as an organisation to start recalibrating ourselves and balancing our strategic capabilities as we understood the conflict circumstances to be playing themselves out going forward. So when I look at the kind of capabilities that we would then have available for deployment, it is significantly larger than what we had for milestone 1. So whilst it is not at the optimum by any manner of means, it is significantly larger. If we look at the graphic and what that means, you'll take note in this. When we say 1 armored brigade minus, it means it's not a full brigade. It is probably 2 battalions. Okay. So that's what the minus means. So it's not quite where we need to be, but you've got the building blocks of where you need to be. That's essentially what it means. So if you look at the graphic, you'll start to see that in terms of the goals that and goals and tasks that the defence review prescribed certain performance against, at milestone 2 at 57 billion as the baseline in 2014-15 rand value terms, you start to see a defence force that can, in pretty much most of what it is responsible for, the 4 goals and the 13 tasks, is able to achieve a significant and a fairly reasonable output from a national security point of view. What it actually looks like inside it means the HR or the people complement starters as well as civilians. It would have a budget of 57 billion. It would attract 5.4% of government expenditure, and the allocation against the GDP of that time would have then moved from 1.1 to 1.6% of GDP. You would start to see a meaningful and a useful defence force at that particular point in time, but you still would not have fully arrested the decline, because you would have to start building back capabilities. When we move to milestone 3, and I'm going to tell you a story about milestone 3 shortly, you start to see a defence capability that in fact can be projected over the whole area of SADC, and we could fulfil the obligations that we had in terms of the SADC Mutual Defence Pact and our relationship with the African Union and the standby force arrangements. So in milestone 3, we would have a defence force that is capable to meet its international obligations, multilateral obligations, and bilateral obligations, defence obligations. And it would be a defence force that can sustainably safeguard our borders, land borders, air and maritime zones. We would sustainably be able to patrol our maritime area and protect our maritime resources, one of the huge challenges that we have now. We would be able to entertain a small, perhaps an additional small, relatively small peace mission within SADC on the African continent. And then, of course, we would start to see the construct and the capability that we could sustainably reach and intervene. We could provide the African Union and the standby force arrangements with the capability to reach and intervene on an almost a sustainable basis. So we would still continue to sustainably then, of course, meet our international obligations. And now we would start to see a type of defence force that you would see in normal military language. I know this type of terminology is probably very confusing for the members, but at some point downstream we can the Major General sitting with me, General Swana, I'm sure will be very happy to come and explain what's inside battalions and what's inside brigades. Because I think it's very interesting to have a look at that, because then you'll see exactly the nature of the beast. And then, of course, so that is essentially what milestone 3 was. We look at the graphic of milestone 3, and this is where you start to see the challenge. If you look at the audit commitments placed on the Defence Force, as they were in 2013-14, they are the same, if not more, now, except for one less peace mission. But there are other commitments that the Defence Force has. So the milestone 3 position, where we assessed that we needed 162 combat units, 140,000 people, 74 billion as a defence allocation baseline, 6.8% of government expenditure against the GDP of that time, and then of course 2% of GDP of that time. Very interestingly, is that the expectations by the executive was that the Defence Force was to perform it. I would like to put it to the committee that in fact we were ordered to perform at this level, and we were performing at this level, but we were being funded less than what we were funding. Funded milestone 1. Performing at milestone 3, funded at milestone 1. Something had to give. That imbalance in terms of funding vis-a-vis output required, audit commitments, accelerated and caused major chaos in terms of being able to sustain our capabilities and our ability to continue to operate sustainably. So whilst the expectation was that Defence got an incremental improvement in its allocation, that never materialised. In fact, the exact reverse of that has happened and continued to further complicate the challenge. Because in real terms, if we take the 43 billion that we had in the 2014-15 financial year, and you apply the real terms to the actual allocation that we've got now, you'll see that we've gone backwards in real terms on 43 billion, and significantly less than that. So that is complicated where we find ourselves.
Is 2.0 as a percentage?
The 2.70 is a percentage of GDP allocated to defence, but it was the GDP of that time. It's not the GDP of today. Because if you were to allocate the 2% of GDP of today, you would find it's a really small figure. In fact, it's something. I'll be honest with you, from a personal perspective, and I must put it on the table, I find it difficult to talk about percentage of GDP allocation for the simple reason that GDP goes up and down, the value of a currency goes up and down. So sometimes you might find that whilst we said, okay, we need 2% for 2 months of the year, we're actually getting 2.6% of GDP, for example. So if you look at how currencies and the value of your currency and the size of your GDP varies, but yet your allocation remains in nominal terms, remains at a certain level, it can translate to be something very different. So I think
it
is a sustainable defence. It does to a large extent if you average it out, but I think the most important thing is it does give you an indication of how the relative importance the government puts at funding defence. And that's where you can get a comparative analysis. If you look around the world, for example, NATO, I think it's very important to bring this in. You in NATO, every country is pressurised to put a minimum of 2% of their GDP into their defence capabilities in support of the NATO alliance. So, I know at the beginning of this year there was a lot of political stories about certain countries that were freeloading, if you like, or free riding on their neighbours and not spending the required amount on defence and leaving that responsibility to their neighbours to do. And it's caused a lot of unhappiness within the NATO alliance, for example. So just to put that on the table. We still haven't got to the milestone four that the cabinet selected as being the kind of level of ambition that we should aspire to. But at milestone three, I think it's important also to note that the recommendation of the Defence Review Committee at that time, when we went to cabinet, was that the milestone three position, we believed, on the analysis of the economic indicators, the analysis of what was required in terms of the strategic environment, the analysis of the security situation, on the analysis of where we were as a defence force and where we needed to be, and what we were likely to face in terms of as being ordered to do so by the executive and by the country, we believed that a very appropriate level of defence would have been milestone three. Cabinet, on the other hand, had a different view. They did not agree with that, and in subsequent engagements with cabinet, cabinet said no. Milestone four is where we need you to be. Milestone three is mainly internally focused. It is not providing South Africa with the gravitas it requires to pursue the African agenda and to meet its ordered commitments and its international obligations on the continent of Africa, at least sub-Saharan Africa. So if I look at the graphic in terms of milestone four, clearly the expectation of cabinet was that this defence force must be able to have an impact, if required to do so, south of the Sahel on the continent of Africa. It's not to say that you're going to be warmongering or deliberately intervening, certainly not unilaterally, but on the basis of our multilateral agreements and the context in which we operate, African Union, Southern African Development Community, United Nations mandates, that we must at least have the ability to be able to make a meaningful contribution to the security arrangements of Africa south of the Sahel. And in that context, we would be able to sustainably 2, 3 and 4, and the most important part of goal 1 being the ability to reach and intervene and the ability to protect our vital interests would have been more than covered, more than acceptably covered. The defend and protect part, which is essentially what you would have to do in the event of war, would then have to be would be kept at a level, but it, not at a level that it doesn't exist. It is certainly there, and that the aggregate of all the other capabilities could certainly, if circumstances change strategically, would be able to deal with the defend and protect function as specified by the Constitution. So that's essentially what the numbers indicated. So we would be looking at 158 combat units, 189,000 people in total, and then of course a budget of about 88 billion a year, 8.2% of government expenditure, 2.4% of GDP. So relatively, I think it's appropriate to compare these numbers across those milestones, because the baseline remains the same, but that's the kind of growth path that the cabinet indicated that they would like to see this defence force grow. If South Africa was to maintain its status on the continent of Africa, and in fact grow its status on the continent of Africa, and become the change agent for Africa going forward. When we then translated that, then there's a number of things the defence force had to do. The force generation guidelines, chapter 10 talks in detail to what we need to do with regard to our defence diplomacy capabilities, and what we do with our military attachés, what are the missions to get involved in, who we should start, and what are the principles around selecting strategic partners on the continent from a defence perspective. It also goes into a lot of detail on our strategic intelligence capabilities, our domain awareness, our abilities to start forecasting events, if you like. It also looks at the role of our special forces and introduces the concept of special operating forces for South Africa, which is a much more capable type of projectable force than just your normal army heavy land forces. Generally, they are projected by land, by sea and by air, and they are what you would use as intervention forces. And then, of course, your medium combat forces, which would be the engine room that you would use for border safeguarding and for a whole host of activities internally. Clearly, we would have strengthened the Navy and have the ability to patrol the deep water as well as to patrol inshore, and to ensure that we protect our marine resources, which we know are under great threat as we speak. And then, of course, the air combat and air mobility capabilities. Air mobility capabilities largely in support of the army forces and in support of the Navy, in their operations, being mainly cross-cutting, but then, of course, the air combat capabilities. We need to also maintain in the army environment, and we appreciate this, because whilst the tendency is not for interstate conflict, but rather intrastate conflict, in other words, challenges within the borders of a country, and whilst the indicators are there that the likelihood of conventional combat in South Africa, where we are geostrategically positioned, is perhaps not where we would think it would justify a massive conventional force. We appreciated the fact that didn't mean to say it would never happen, not by any means, because the projection capabilities of other countries around the world is so significant that they can land a conventional force in this country very rapidly. So the decision by the review committee and the recommendation was that we maintained a core of conventional combat capabilities, but at a level that we could use them to supplement our existing operations, and in particular where we are involved in, for example, the Force Intervention Brigade, where we do peace enforcement operations. And that's exactly what we do in, for example, the Eastern DRC. Then, of course, our health efforts. we have to bear in mind in our defence allocation, and by the way, part of the allocation, so when we talk about a 74 billion budget or an 88 billion budget, a significant part of that is money that we as a defence force would spend and give to defence industry to equip us as a defence force.
Sorry, before I lose it, if you are saying these would be the performance indicators of a milestone 4.
Yes.
Of milestone 4.
Yes.
That if we achieve milestone 4, we'll see these things.
Absolutely. But you would start to see, these capabilities come to the fore from milestone 2 onwards.
From milestone 2 onwards.
Yeah. Particularly 3 and 4, you would see this very clearly. Okay. So if that is what we're going to do, and that is exactly what Cabinet agreed upon, and that was the recommendation of the Defence Review Committee, this is what we need to do. As a country, geostrategically positioned on the southern tip of Africa, and the importance of this country on the continent of Africa, that is what we need to do. But to back this up, obviously, we need to put particular emphasis and effort into developing our future military leaders. One of the things that defence forces do is they develop leaders, not only for themselves as organisations, but also for countries. And I think that an interrelationship of defence leadership programmes and developing leaders in the defence force at a level that those leaders can come back into society and impact society, one must not underestimate that. And as a result of that, certain recommendations were made. We looked at military discipline and made specific pronouncements on military discipline, and I know there's a lot of work being done as we speak on a new military disciplinary bill which tries to capture the essence of what was required. Defence management systems is a very detailed discussion on the defence management systems and how we manage defence and how defence would work, and then of course the specific focus areas with regard to that, organisational structuring, etc., etc. And then, of course, the resource systems and how we intend to manage our resources and go forward. I'm not going to go into the detail of this. You have it in front of you. There were particular priorities that were identified for personnel, for logistics, for procurement, for ICT equipment, or what we call information communication systems, and then, of course, for finance and how we seek to take these aspects forward. A number of issues came out of it. For example, the Defence Enterprise Information System. We have a number of disparate legacy systems that don't help us in decision making. What we needed to do over time was we needed to get the balance between the funding of our HR component, our operating component, and our equipping or capital component corrected. And it was very simple, on an incremental increase in growing the defence force through to milestone 4 over time, even if you only got to milestone 3. As you got to milestone 2, the relationship between HR, operating, and capital would start to restore itself, because it was largely happened on the back of reductions to the allocation without reducing the footprint of the organisation. So the skew that we currently find of about 58% on HR, 30-odd on operating, and less than 10% on capital is largely as a result of the knock-on effect of the reductions to the defence allocation over time, more than it is the so-called HR got out of control. It didn't. The numbers are pretty much, in fact, the numbers are less than what they were when we started with the defence review. So over time, we would seek to restore a more healthy balance in those particular components. The last chapter is about the defence industry. And I think it's worth mentioning here, and whilst the chapter itself speaks in some detail of, for example, the defence scientist and the role of the defence scientist, it speaks in detail about what a sovereign defence industry, speaks in detail of the development of the defence industry strategy, a sector strategy, the National Defence Industry Council, etc., a lot of things. What is important here is it is the critical interdependence between the defence industry and defence-related industry to the defence force, and this defence force able to embark upon sovereign growth, if you like. So in conclusion, Chair, I think that if we sit back here and we think that the world is not becoming more insecure and more dangerous, then we're living in a fool's paradise. I mean, we can see it on a daily basis. We see it in this country. We see how internal challenges have risen. They didn't exist 6 or 7 years ago. We can indicate to you exactly how they've grown over time. Issues around human security. So we as a country need to look at the strategic partnerships that we've got. We need to promote peace and stability. We need to look at the routine of democracy underpinned by strong ethical governance on the continent of Africa. We need to look at economic advancement for African prosperity. And we need to look at strengthening our participation, certainly, but also the effectiveness of the multilateral mechanisms. I think it is very important that we recognize that the role of defense, the traditional roles of defense as you saw them in the Cold War, have fundamentally changed from being purely a protector of a nation state to something that is perhaps a little bigger and has a great deal of opportunity, and it's really been a strategic enabler and a catalyst for change wherever it is applied. And it's not a utopian view, it's a very practical view. And one can look at many examples of our own defence force involved and intervening in places where the result has been a much better outcome than what they found when they went in. So I think it's very important that we, if we want South Africa to succeed and to be the country that we think it should be on the continent of Africa, we need a defence force that is commensurate with that. And of course, when we presented this is an old slide show, when we presented this, we said the adoption of this defence review, with all the decisions that went with it, including the funding trajectory, was an urgent matter that was required in order to stabilise the defence capability for South Africa. Chair, thank you very much for listening to us. I think that's the essence of the defence review. As I'm sure that I can speak on behalf of my colleagues, that we stand ready to engage in a lot more detail should you require it going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. Good presentation. The office of the secretary was adequately represented. Let me say the difference was adequately represented today. And we are certainly better. Now we can interact with the book. I won't repeat, but you know, and I got lost before I reached chapter 2. You know? And, but now after this presentation, I'm much more empowered. I will be able to go through it from page 1 to the last page, because you have just given us a highlight of what was intended in the first place. You know, that now we know. And we're not going to deal with questions and comments, but I want us to have a second round of discussions with you. You just go back to slide number 36, or slide number 34. Slide number 34, all right. 34, just go step in this one, go back. No, just move forward then.
It's the
just move forward. No, this maximum one, yeah, master one, correct.
The one.
Next one. Right. Okay. The master one. Let's look at the combat units and the people required for the army. So we are saying we have regressed from the situation that we were at the time when the last period was his, but we've been able to stretch it beyond, be much, much, much beyond his last period. At least that we know. But in terms of people, how, to what extent have we been able to stretch the people, because the army is meant, you know, beyond what is usually the norm within the army. Hence the talk of renewal, rejuvenation, and all that. I think that's the box now we need to unpack. To say, this is where we are, and this is where we were when we started this thing, and this is how much we've progressed. This is our topic. Oh yes, this is our topic. This is our topic. But
this is not where we are.
This is not where we are. But you have even, you see, the numbers doesn't tell you about the actual fitness.
Exactly.
You see, it gives you that number. But is can the number as it stands swing into action? Thank you so much. Let me thank you for you. Please for being my way.